person or a father should not hit his child on the face or the head. They are two sensitive areas
right.
that could cause a lot of damage, especially the head, for example, could cause him a lot of concussion, could cause brain damage, could cause a lot of number of life-lasting illnesses.
Right.
And also scarring the face, also it is a problem as well, because the child, some of the scars last forever as well, and the child has to face people, whether at school or around, and he can't be constantly looking at himself and right. seeing the devastation that being made.
Well, expanding and on that, dear Sayyid, if I may interrupt, you also have the Islamic ruling of you're also not allowed to hit an animal on the head or on the face.
Yeah, well, obviously you should not hit anything on the head or the face.
Right,
because, whether it's an animal or a human, it's very an inhumane act.
Exactly, like even to an animal, we're not allowed to do this, but you do this to a child.
Sometimes people don't do it to animals, but actually do it to their children.
Exactly, yeah.
Which is quite strange.
Yeah.
Because we just don't think about it. We don't see it in this way, because we think that the children are ours and we are...
They are
angry,
playthings.
And we have the choice and we have the right to do so, which
right.
we don't. So
they'll bounce back. It's okay.
Exactly. So we said that you have to make sure that that does not happen
of
at
course.
All.
Right.
Okay. And we said that if a person needs to hit, it has to be a less, not too much, and it probably would be better on the feet or the hand. I remember our teachers back in the day, they used to hit us either on our hands
or
at the back of our feet. Because,
right.
The soles. It's still painful for some reason, but at least it's the areas that can heal a lot faster.
Right.
Unless you go, hit very hard.
Yeah.
But that's, and even back in the day in England, for example, in America, back in the 60s and 50s and 40s,
right.
they used to hit children on the bum in school or the parents, like they whoop them with a belt. So in a place where it doesn't leave at least a mark.
It's not permanent.
It's not permanent.
It can heal at least.
Yeah,
it
could heal a lot quicker than any other part of the body. So that has to be taken into consideration. Also the parents have to take into consideration that they should not hit the child in front of people. Not only that will cause them pain physically, but it also causes them a lot of pain mentally. So this is something that we should avoid at all times.
And on that note, let's go ahead and take a quick break.
The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam said, "Love children. Be kind to them, and whenever you promise something to them, fulfill it."
Welcome back, dear listeners. You are listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. Today we are discussing what not to do in a situation where you want to hit your child or you feel that you are forced to do so, and how to deal with such a situation if you really think that you are forced to hit your child. There are some regulations, some limits you should at least try to follow. Dear Sayyid, please enlighten us further.
So these are a few things that we need to consider when it comes to hitting children. And obviously, if we keep these things in mind, then no one's going to hit his child, at least. And if they do, it wouldn't be much of hitting if this point kept in mind.
Right.
And especially sometimes when these things happen, which I think we might touched upon last night or last episode, is that when you have two siblings and they get into a fight and they want to discipline one and not the other.
Yeah.
So there are also a few things that you need to keep in mind to keep the justice, at least in terms of punishment with kids. You can't just punish one and leave the other. That will cause a lot of problems. So if you see two kids, for example, and both of the siblings are fighting, you can't just, hit one and leave the other one. So if they need to punish, both of them have to be punished. At least they would feel the other one does
There's
not
some
feel
justice.
Neglected. He feels
right.
a bit of justice, okay? So yeah, I got hit, she got hit, we're good. You know? If I get hit and she doesn't get hit, even I know that she had some of, you know, as a child, I know that she had a part of this issue.
Right.
But she, you know, she got away with it. I'm going to feel, not only I feel that upset that I got hit, but I also feel upset that she got away with it.
It becomes a whole drama, say, yeah, like, so he's the oppressed one now, and she's the one who got spoiled, and this starts a whole other episode.
I'm speaking from a child's mentality, right?
Yeah.
So we should not, as parents, if you need to punish, make sure you punish both of them, not one of them. Right. I'm not saying, like, hit them both, but at least if you want to do any sort of punishment, it has to be done on one of them to have that that justice happening between the kids.
Right.
And also you have to make sure that if you want to punish children, you have to make sure that you don't punish an innocent child as well in the process. Because sometimes people get angry at one child, and then all of a sudden the other one get bashed as well for no apparent reason.
Everybody in the vicinity. Like yeah, if you even just look at the angry parent or just breathe in a way, you get it too. Rest assured.
Yeah, so I've seen parents when they get angry, like, you know, one child does something stupid and the other child had nothing to do with it, also get hit. For example, parents walk in the house and, you know, one is making him angry, the one next to him also cops something. Or sometimes when they want to punish a child, an innocent child, for example, one of them done something wrong, so the father says, no TV for the... No one is watching TV. He's trying to punish one child, but in the process, he punished everyone else.
It's the same thing in school, if you remember, in the classroom. If somebody threw something or didn't do their homework, everybody gets punished. How is this justice?
Exactly, exactly. That's not horrible justice. Feeling. That makes you hate the teacher, makes you hate everything.
Exactly,
So we have to make sure that if we punish a child, we don't punish a child as innocent, and that we do not include everybody in that punishment. Has to be done fairly and justly.
And inshallah, keeping that in mind, we will have to end today's program because we are out of time. I thank the dear Sayyid for his insightful knowledge, and I also thank the dear listeners for tuning in. If our dear listeners have any questions or comments or some feedback, please, please, please contact us at our email, englishradio@irib.ir. You can also visit our website, parstoday.com. Alternatively, if you're not such a big fan of these two methods, old-fashioned methods, you can also find us on the various social media sites, such as on Twitter and Instagram, under the call handle of Call of Islam Radio. Thank you for tuning in.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Erubashavet, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alami, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
When Saudi Arabia launched an air campaign on Yemen in March 2015, it assured the U.S. administration of President Barack Obama that it would oust the Ansarullah movement within months. But the war, aimed at restoring a former friendly government in the Yemeni capital Sana'a, dragged on with limited military gains. Under Obama, whose government had close bonds with Saudi Arabia, indiscriminate and disproportionate airstrikes continued on Yemen. Homes, markets, schools, hospitals, weddings, and funerals were targeted with U.S.-made weapons, including widely banned cluster munitions. An all-out Saudi blockade exacerbated Yemen's health and nutrition crises, and diseases like cholera began to spread like wildfire. and all those happened amid military and diplomatic support provided by the Obama administration. The U.S. also stood silent in 2016 when Saudi Arabia, through threats of cutting funds to the UN, finally forced the world body to drop it from its list of the worst offenders against children for its attacks on Yemeni kids. Obama lost all chances to stop the slaughter. Donald Trump followed in the footsteps of his predecessor in supporting Saudi Arabia and made his first trip as U.S. president to the Arab Kingdom. Hours after landing in the Saudi capital Riyadh on the 20th of May 2017, Trump sealed a $350 billion arms deal with King Salman, the largest in world history. The transaction included tanks, combat ships, missile defense systems, as well as radar, communications, and cybersecurity technology. 2 years later, the U.S. president vetoed a bipartisan resolution to force stop America's involvement in Yemen's bloodshed. Like Obama, Trump, too, missed all the chances to end this slaughter.
This war has to end.
That's what incumbent Joe Biden said last year, just weeks into his presidency, announcing an end to U.S. assistance for Saudi Arabia's offensive operations in Yemen, as well as relevant arms sales. However, months later, that promise was broken as his government approved two arms deals worth over $1 billion. To support the United Arab Emirates against Yemen's retaliatory attacks, the U.S. is now deploying a destroyer and fighter jets in the UAE, a key member of the Saudi-led military coalition. France also says it will give military support to the UAE to help it protect its airspace. The Biden administration is also planning to bring Yemen's Ansarullah movement back on a U.S. blacklist. Aid organizations warn that the move would prevent the delivery of critical humanitarian assistance to millions of innocent people and could have adverse humanitarian consequences.
It will have much effect on Yemeni civilians because many UN agency and NGOs are working in Yemen. If the United States will continue or if they will declare the Houthi as a terrorist group, this will have a huge and a bad effect on Yemeni civilians.
By sticking to warmongering policies, the current U.S. president is also missing on his chances to stop the war, a conflict that the UN says has already turned Yemen into the largest humanitarian crisis in the world.
The European Union Agency for Asylum, EUAA, says new refugee applications in the 27-country bloc are at a five-year high, mainly being submitted by Afghans and Syrians. On Wednesday, 19 refugees were found dead on the border between Turkey and EU nation Greece. It's believed they died from hypothermia. The European Commission claims it's trying to gather further information. EU Home Affairs ministers have been meeting to try and advance the bloc's new refugee policy, known as the Migration Pact.
The strategy of all or nothing up to now has actually given us nothing, and this is not good for member states or the European Union. We want to breathe new life into the EU Migration Pact.
When it comes to the refugee crisis, civil society organizations and many EU lawmakers make the point that the West never learns from its mistakes. They are expressing concern that stoking tensions with Russia over Ukraine has the potential to create a new refugee crisis. It's suggested war hawks in the US and NATO don't give a damn about the millions of people who have been displaced through military intervention in countries such as Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, Yemen, and Libya. As the EU's Poland and Lithuania construct a new wall along their borders with Belarus, the European Commission is promising billions of euro to expand and arm the bloc's border agency, Frontex.
Frontex is by far the biggest agency we ever had. And we are setting it up right now, and it's huge. It's going to have 10,000 armed people at our external borders.
The EU's own data shows 100,000 children and teenagers go missing in the bloc every year. Most of those are refugees. Campaigners are calling for greater cooperation between police forces.
There need to be better information sharing platforms so we know exactly how many children are going missing and what are the actual risks that they face, because right now, nobody knows.
With EU nations refusing to take in refugees and as billions are spent on keeping them out, rights groups are again asking, where are the bloc's much trumpeted values? Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
In overcrowded dinghies and often in the cover of darkness, migrants, among them people running away from wars and instability, take to the choppy waters separating France from the UK. Some make it, others die trying. 27 of them in November last year alone. An incident that further strained the fragile ties between Paris and London. French President Emmanuel Macron says Britain's reliance on illegal immigrant labor is behind the surge in numbers crossing from France and in their deaths.
I think it's definitely political because he's getting set to run his election campaign. You know, we've had Brexit as well, so we know that that has impacted. But the reality is we're talking about human beings. So this is not about political point scoring, or it shouldn't be about political point scoring between governments.
Britain says the French president is absolutely wrong, that the government here is searching for ways to stop the crossings. This is what Interior Minister Priti Patel had to say in the wake of those tragic deaths in November.
We're not working just to end these crossings because we don't care or we're heartless. There's no quick fix. This is about addressing long-term pull factors, smashing criminal gangs that treat human beings as cargo, and tackling supply chains.
To do that, Britain wants France to let British police patrol French beaches. It has ruled out physically pushing boats back across the English Channel. It wants to give people traffickers life sentences and has introduced a controversial bill that will allow it to send migrants to detention centers in other countries. To campaigners, that is draconian and racist.
The Nationality and Borders Bill seeks to make it even more difficult for people to seek asylum in Britain, which again is a contravening international human rights laws. It will also mean that there's a higher scrutiny of people. There are tighter deadlines as it stands.
More than 28,000 migrants crossed the English Channel in 2021, triple the number the year before.
And while British and French leaders continue to trade accusations, more desperate migrants will embark on that perilous journey across the English Channel, and that will almost certainly mean more deaths. Saeed Pourreza, London.
It is the revolution that continues to reverberate around the globe. Iran's Islamic Revolution ushering in a new age by ousting the US-backed Pahlavi regime. Father Frank Gehli, who became an ordained minister, recalls his initial reaction when news of the revolution broke.
At the time, I considered myself quite left-wing, so I enjoyed the idea there should be a revolution against the Shah. So I considered the Shah a tyrant.
One of the most inspirational things about the Islamic Revolution for its many admirers is not just the impact that it's had inside of Iran, but it's the growing legacy that it continues to build globally. For political observers, Iran's stoic path proved an innovative and bold new model where alliances could be forged and solidarity fostered.
Because of its anti-imperialistic values, that's why Iran has good relations with lots of other countries around the world, Muslim and non-Muslim, that have also suffered colonialism and occupation. I mean, it could be Cuba, it could be Venezuela, many countries in Africa around the world who, you know, have a certain affinity with Iran because of that.
There's also another element to those who admire the aims and accomplishments of the revolution.
The Iranian revolution, as I mentioned, it tells us how you don't have to have only one model of political system. Whereby, I mean, here in this country, we have a monarch who is head of a national church, but it's a farce. In reality, God has been pushed out of a public sphere, and so the whole thing is a charade. In Iran, there is a valuable presence or faith in the public sphere.
As the revolution moves towards another remarkable milestone, the West still continues its opposition campaign despite a lack of success.
I can't think of too many examples of countries around the world that have withstood the barrage of war, sanctions, media hatred, internal subterfuge, kind of instigated from outside, that Iran has. Yet they're still here, and they're not just surviving by the skin of their teeth, they're thriving as well. They have a strong military. They have strong regional allies. They have political influence, especially within their area in the Middle East. I think that it's widely recognized, even by haters of Iran, that Iran is one of the major regional players.
With its legacy still rippling across the globe, supporters of the Islamic Revolution internationally know they owe Iran and Iranians a great debt. Amina Taylor, London.
Come April, many Britons will have to choose between heating and eating. Everything from bus fares to mortgages are going to cost more. Interest rates have gone up twice in 7 weeks, and three more hikes are on the horizon as the central bank tries to tackle the situation. The opposition members of parliament are livid, saying the government is incompetent.
He doesn't like it, Mr. Speaker, when children in my constituency go to bed with no food in their tummies, with no heat in their homes. What does he really think is the honourable position of a Chancellor who has just allowed one of his policies directly to be taken in fraud, £4.3 billion of fraud under his watch? Any other Chancellor that I've known would have come to the House today to resign.
This week, millions learnt that their gas and electricity bills are going to jump 54%. The government says there's nothing it can do with energy prices going up worldwide.
I don't believe them at all. You know, I'm sure they know, you know, and this is just to put people more in poverty, you know. And it's not right, it's not fair, you know. People working very hard.
When you look at the price of things now, everything going up higher than it was. And that's why so many people on the street, living on the street, because they can't afford to eat or drink.
Well, I feel like it's government responsible to support people who are in this horrible situation. Because I had a problem this year myself. I couldn't find an apartment because the prices went up crazy twice.
Also causing inflation to rise is supply chain issues, higher import taxes and wages increasing. Brexit, the pandemic and a global energy crisis, a perfect storm for Britain, now in the grips of its worst economic slump in 300 years. But who will have to pay for it all?
On April 1st, the cost of living will be going up £3,000 a year for each household. On the very same day, British politicians will be getting a £2,000 a year pay rise. From this, it is clear that those that are on top of the pile have their bills covered, and it's those on the breadline that will be picking up those bills. Bianca Rahimi, London.
$110,000 relief packages for 110,000 underprivileged families are loaded on trucks and are ready to go to their destinations. The humanitarian gesture was initiated by the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps in Tehran. The IRGC says the charity supplies contain staple food, health items, and dowries for newlywed couples.
110,000 aid packages are being dispatched to families with low income, with a focus on those who have lost their businesses during the pandemic. The majority of the charitable supplies include the necessary items needed for an average family in a month. We have also provided 313 dowries for 313 newly wed couples.
The humanitarian gesture comes as part of nationwide celebrations marking the 43rd anniversary of the victory of Iran's 1979 Islamic Revolution. The IRGC says one of the goals of this move is to share the festive mood with those in need.
We're celebrating the 43rd year after the victory of the Islamic Revolution, so we want to spread joy and happiness by helping those who cannot make ends meet. If we the people join hands and help each other, no foreign plot and no sanctions can bring us to our knees.
While the IRGC is known as a military institution, it has a strong presence in social and economic arenas. It says it feels bound to serve the Islamic Republic whenever there's a call to action, be it military or civilian.
Every year during the anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution, charities in Iran ramp up their activities. The IRGC says the occasion is a chance to put a smile on the faces of the less privileged families, in line with one of the slogans of the Islamic Revolution, and that's the elimination of poverty. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Food and energy prices are soaring across the 19-nation eurozone, placing enormous pressures on cash-strapped consumers. Inflation hit a record high of 5.1% in January. The matter was debated in the European Parliament on Wednesday.
I'm highly concerned about the combination of high and increasing levels of inflation and a central bank that refuses to normalize its monetary policy.
The story is not the same everywhere. For example, Belgium has an inflation rate of 8%. In France, it's just 2.5%.
Hence, we will see divergence in international competitiveness of the member states of the euro area. We've seen in the past the misery that comes about when you have that kind of development.
The economic impact of COVID-19 has disproportionately hit young adults in the EU. Homelessness and mental health problems are rife. For example, here in Belgium, PreventSuicide.be published a report on Tuesday showing calls to its helpline have skyrocketed. A record 22,000 were made last year, an increase of 20% on the previous year. The vast majority of those desperately reaching out for support are young people. Due to growing public debt, EU governments have been cutting investment in crucial areas such as education.
That cannot be the right way forward. We are increasingly in a knowledge economy in Europe. We need to invest in our people to really be competitive.
The potential fallout from a conflict between Western-backed Ukraine and Russia is fueling economic uncertainty in the EU.
This is something we have to factor into our economic analysis. And geopolitical tensions and issues, of course, have to be recognised.
Some EU lawmakers say the West should stop provoking Russia and instead put the best interests of citizens first. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
France's ambassador to Mali has been kicked out of the country in a major blow to the neo-colonial sphere of influence known as France-Afrique. The reasons included undiplomatic language from Paris towards a new military government in the capital of Bamako, but also sanctions on Mali, which have raised food prices, and especially the failure of almost a decade of French-led war. France first declared war in overwhelmingly Muslim Mali without the United Nations' approval, allegedly to fight religious extremists. 9 years later, with thousands dead and a million refugees, public opinion has turned massively against France.
Polls show that 80% of Malians in the capital think that France was only there to defend French interests. It's an opinion which Paris has blamed on Russian disinformation.
Public opinion is also reportedly strongly supportive of expelling the French ambassador, as well as of the military.
Dans la vision occidentale,
in the Western vision of things, there isn't a desire to respect the majority will of these people, or to help install a minimum of democracy, and thus a government with a minimum of credibility. If you install a government which is pro-Western and which doesn't reflect the popular will, then of course you will create anti-occupation sentiment because you become a hostile force yourself.
The bold move by Mali comes just days after Burkina Faso's military seized the heads of state, even as French soldiers were on a mission in the country. In the past 18 months, other revolts in Guinea, as well as in Chad and Niger, have many wondering if France is losing its neo-colonial hold on sub-Saharan Africa.
Les intérêts français dans la région.
France's interests in the region are threatened by new players such as China, Russia, and even Qatar, which has invested a lot there. We can no longer say this is a region which is under total French domination, because there is now competition. However, as long as the local governments are corrupt, they can be easily influenced by foreign powers.
France's military has stalled for time, saying a total military withdrawal from Mali will be discussed in the coming days. Rami Mazahiri, Paris.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Anti-war advocates have recently accused the Biden administration of continued warmongering after President Joe Biden confirmed he plans to send U.S. troops to Eastern Europe. Please stay with us for an article in this regard written by Julia Conley, journalist. This article is published under the heading Anti-war groups pan Biden for announcing troop deployment to Eastern Europe. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Anti-war advocates have recently accused the Biden administration of continued warmongering after President Joe Biden confirmed he plans to send U.S. troops to Eastern Europe. Biden told reporters at Joint Base Andrews recently, "I will be moving troops to Eastern Europe in the NATO countries in the near term, not too many." Earlier this week, the president announced that 8,500 troops were standing ready for a potential deployment to confront what the White House claims is an imminent attack by Russian forces in Ukraine, despite pleas by Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky to stop creating panic.
In a recent phone call, Zelensky reportedly questioned the Biden administration's belief and claim promoted by the corporate media that a Russian invasion is imminent. I am the president of Ukraine. I am based here, and I think I know the details deeper than any other president, Zelensky told the press after the call, adding, the image that mass media creates is that we have troops on the roads, we have mobilization, people are leaving for places. That's not the case. We don't need this panic. Veteran journalist John Pilger tweeted that Zelensky's comments exposed the warmongering of Biden as a crime. As Common Dreams reported recently, U.S. War Secretary Lloyd Austin expressed hope that the diplomatic approach could avoid conflict with Russia, which has demanded a guarantee that Ukraine will be excluded from NATO along with other security measures. Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman Mark Milley also spoke recently and called on Russian President Vladimir Putin to pursue diplomacy after Putin reportedly spoke to French President Emmanuel Macron about implementing a diplomatic agreement forged in 2014. Milley warned that there will be horrific consequences if Russia invades Ukraine. Given the type of forces that are arrayed, the ground maneuver forces, the artillery, the ballistic missiles, the air forces, all of it packaged together, if that was unleashed on Ukraine, it would be significant, very significant, and it would result in a significant amount of casualties, he told reporters. Peace group Code Pink accused the Biden administration of reaching, putting the entire world at risk, while the U.S. public and international leaders make clear their anti-war stance. Russia doesn't want war. Ukraine doesn't want war. The American people don't want war, tweeted the group, adding, the Biden administration needs to get with the program and stop endangering us all.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the pit.
On Youth Station.
Youth Station.
I am a Muslim.
I am a Muslim.
Islamadi.
Islamadi.
Allah my Lord.
Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet.
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be upon.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Youth Station. Choo choo ka choo. It's the Youth Station for you.
Yeah, that's very true.
It grows.
That's
on
the
you.
Sound of Youth Station.
Exactly. Even, like at the beginning, you don't like it. You're like, what is this?
The motto of Youth Station.
I'm Muzaffar Haider.
Yes, and I'm Asma.
Sister. So I stumbled across this new word.
Yes.
It's, I like discovering new words, especially if they sound like this. Driblisa.
Yeah, it's so it sounds so archaic.
Yeah, it's like driblisa. What is driblisa? It's apparently an English word.
Yes, of course it is. Mm. It is perhaps the addition of two words, dream and bliss. Like a bliss that happens only in your dreams, in your imagination.
So they took out the M, dream.
Yes,
bliss.
In order to make it phonetically easier.
Uh-huh, okay.
So it is Drimblisa, but it is Dimblisa.
Driblisa. Okay.
Yes, Driblisa. Yeah. So, yes, sometimes we have some imaginations about some people, but those imaginations are not totally true. We should never think of any human being as a perfect creation.
Oh, you can say that.
There's
again.
No masterpiece.
Oh, my God. That
If you no, never do that. Never think of somebody as perfect. Unless it's
it
the
happens to all of us. We put people on the pedestal, but suddenly, very suddenly, our entire trust is broken.
Yeah,
and we come up like, oh my God, I shouldn't have trusted those people. And in the end, you're going to turn into a person who is scared of trusting other people or situations, perhaps, or getting into new relationships.
And sometimes you don't only damage yourself. You can damage that person that you have that perception about as well, because they don't even realize that you have that perception of them.
Yes, of course.
And you're thinking of them as some sort of angel, and they're like, well, why are you expecting all that?
They turn out to be the other way.
Yeah, sometimes.
So perfection is the thing that does not exist in this world. I told you, there is no masterpiece. When I'm in a relationship, I should notice the very fact that my friend is a human being, that a person I'm longing to have a relationship with is a breathing being. So he is not the... you know the story of Pygmalion we have in literature?
No.
There was a person who was a sculptorist. He made sculptures. So he created a sculpture. It is in mythology. And then Bernard Shaw wrote a play out of it.
Okay.
The sculptorist made a sculpture. And he loved that sculpture so much in a way that he cried before that sculpture. And he longed for that sculpture to turn into a human being. And then when that sculpture turned into a human being, it was not exactly the same way as he wished for it. So the story of Pygmalion was something like that. You have something in your imagination about somebody, but that thing turns out to be a different thing. The flower you are watering and in the hope of one day turning out into a tree of delicious fruits, you turn out to suddenly understand that that plant is not fruiting at all, is not making fruit at all. So we should never have such idealistic ideas on people, because we might turn out to be the one who loses their trust on humanity.
And of course this applies to a greater extent, I'd say, to the representatives of the religion, especially to scholars, you know, because they, you know, speaking for myself and for other scholars out there, when you're wearing the clothing of the prophet, it's going to reflect.
You're the symbol of religion.
You become a symbol of the religion, and it's a huge and almost devastating responsibility, to the extent that if you commit a small mistake, it can you know, have completely devastating
consequences.
People
around you have a magnifier in their hands, and they're watching you in a zoomed up picture, so you have to be so perfect. You are not going to be, because you are a human being, and many things can happen in the lifetime of a human being.
This is IRIB English Radio. You are listening to Youth Station.
I looked up the word Driblisa, and it came up with having happiness, or like liking someone because of a good dream that you've had about them.
Yes. Yes, it is. No, but imagination, yes. The story of Pygmalion has many times happened to me. I say, okay, this photo that I have created of that person is so true and so perfect and so colorful. But when I go deep down, I see the devil coming out to me. Hold back and say, I should not give people my trust so easily.
It's all about expectations. And sometimes it's expectations that we have of ourselves as well, right?
I mean, yes.
Sometimes you admire somebody else. Sometimes it's even worse. You admire yourself because of the image that you've created of yourself in your head.
Yes, in some situations you come to know yourself that you're not what you thought you are. And those situations are very... sometimes very strange, because it becomes like a you become like a weird picture in front of yourself. You do not know yourself. And those situations are very difficult to bear.
as time passes, you start to know yourself more and more. But yeah, you do realize at one point that you never knew yourself at all.
You know, the new generation, as we are all youngsters, the new generation usually do that. I mean, if they have a friend, if they have a professor, if they have, I don't know, somebody at work, they look at them like they are some perfect human beings. But the consequence of that expectation, as you said, is very horrible, because sometimes you're not just losing your trust, but you become such a timid person, you won't get to trust people anymore. You would turn into a lonesome person. You won't get to...
I remember in my time of innocence when we were kids in school, and the teacher would say one swear word. Not even a bad swear word, you know, just like, damn it, or something. There's something slightly worse than that, and you'd be like, oh, how can you do that?
Yes.
And then you don't realize that...
She uses those words too.
Yeah. You're like, what? But you can't. You're a teacher. How can you do that? Then when you grow up, you realize that, oh, okay.
Yes, and that's the way of life. Well, human beings have two parts. I think like the moon. Half of the moon, we see it. The other half of the moon is invisible to us.
That's amazing, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
The dark side of the moon is actually never facing the Earth.
Yes, and we never see that part.
We've never seen it.
Yes, we've never seen it.
What if it turns around one day and we see something terrifying?
That's going to be so scary. Just imagine that in the sky, something turns out to be so horrible.
Yeah. But it could be something beautiful as well. You know, it could be.
Maybe.
Yeah. Have you ever experienced that sometimes your relationship with somebody is really good, like you've got a really good friend and you're talking to them, they're happy, you're happy. The next day, for apparently no reason,
they show you their worst.
They're just like turned off from you. They just don't like you anymore. Or you just feel this kind of weird distance. Like,
I mean, it's been a long life, so yes, it has happened.
Yeah.
Even if I don't remember, but I remember the feeling that I had.
Don't you feel like they might have had a bad dream about you?
Maybe it happens to some people.
But you don't remember most
of your
dreams.
Nothing is impossible.
You don't remember most of your dreams.
Yes, we don't remember.
Because whenever you're sleeping, you are dreaming. Your brain just doesn't stop moving and taking you different places. The point is, you just don't remember it when you wake up.
Yes.
And even though you don't remember what happened, the subconscious memories stay with you. So if you've had certain bad dreams about somebody, then in the day, you're going to treat them a little bit differently. And if you've had good dreams about somebody, you're going to treat them differently as well. You're going to be happier around them.
Yes.
You're
we could also take that as a metaphor, you know, if we consider dreaming and that imagination and expectations that we have of people. We could put it this way, that just like the dreams, when we wake up, we sometimes don't remember anything, or we don't just put so much credits on those dreams. In real life also, about our imaginations, we don't have to give them so much of credits. We have to take them so moderately. I mean, even if we think that somebody is very good, we should put some space for them, that they are human beings and they might go exactly the other way of what we have thought of them. True?
Yeah, I don't like that feeling. It makes things really unpredictable and...
You have to be all the time suspecting things.
And the Quran says, you know, avoid most of suspicion.
Yes.
Sometimes suspicion can even be, you know, ithm. It can even be a sin. Do you ever feel like you're living two lives? Because you wake up and you don't remember your dreams.
A double life.
Yeah, you really are living a double life, because when you wake up, you don't remember your dreams. Then when you go to sleep, you don't remember what you were doing in the day.
Yes.
You have an entire life that you're living.
No, it's interesting.
During your sleep.
I think it's interesting.
You have no real memory of what you were doing in your sleep. Where you were going, who you were talking to.
I think the brain goes where it wants to go. So it's not like I don't remember anything. I remember, but I'm not in it. It's my brain. It's my soul, perhaps.
It is your soul at certain points, but even then you don't remember it.
Yes, we don't remember it. Is it bad that we don't remember it?
I think
sometimes
it's
good that we don't remember it.
Why? Do you think terrible things are happening?
Yes, because some dreams are so terrible.
a lot of what's in the subconscious mind is forming your opinions about people and how you interact with people.
Exactly, the subconscious.
And there is so much in the subconscious mind that we just don't have access to. We can't access it. We don't know what's there. It is so dark and deep.
And there's something. How could we teach that to our kids? I mean, how shall I teach my younger brother or sister that you should have this idea that people are not perfect? You shouldn't go for too much of idealistic thoughts about people. There's no one who's perfect. If you are religious, be religious for your own credits. Mm. Don't let that be invested on a person. Because if that person does something wrong, then your entire creed is going to be crushed. So you're going to be in an abyss. It's going to be very difficult for you. How should we teach the youngsters, the kids? How should we tell them that it's a dangerous world? True, but then don't be too dependent on people, on the images you have of people.
Mm. I don't know, because when you say that, I'm thinking of my kids.
So
I wouldn't know how to even start with that with her, because I don't want her to know how terrifying the world is right now.
Has she ever talked to you about such an experience? I mean, she trusted her friend and then...
Well, she had one experience with one other girl who was not very nice to her.
Yes.
You know, and that was really like, it was a new experience for her. She'd never experienced kind of bullying or anything of that nature, right? So it was... It was interesting to see how it affected her because it was such a new experience. It was very like emotionally taxing for her.
Of course.
You know?
So we take it that from the very early ages of our life, we'll learn that we shouldn't
make a perfect
image of other people.
But then she has other girlfriends that she loves. You know, and she probably admires certain people. I mean, she admires me, right?
That's a problem.
That's really scary. It's like, man, wait till you get a bit older and you realize I'm nothing. I don't know. You can't. For children, I don't think you can pop that bubble.
It's a very sad feeling when you have an image and that image is broken.
Yeah.
Why do we expect people to be too good?
Because... we are naturally inclined towards hero worship.
Hero worship, that's a good point.
Right?
Yes.
But that's going to have to be a topic for the next time because we've unfortunately run out of time.
Time flies.
Yeah, it does. So, we've been discussing about Driblisa.
Yes, Driblisa.
Driblisa, Driblisa, it's this... basically, your thoughts and your opinions about somebody are shaped because of... imaginations, and because
some
of
good imaginations,
things which
some
have
perfect
been deposited
images you have
into
of
your
those
subconscious,
people.
And the expectations that you have. We hope that you enjoyed and benefited from the discussion, inshallah. From myself and from Sister Asma, we bid you assalamu alaikum wa fi amanillah.
Yes, fi amanillah.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 41 meters, 7300 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastorday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.